The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
All ministers and officials should now go to Case Orange. Repeat, this is an official colonial government broadcast.
Hey, boys and girls, Mark and Tricia here. The episode you're about to listen, the season 3 premiere for Occupation Precipice, features Ronald D. Moore as our special guest. He was wonderful and fantastic, and we went deep on both this episode and kind of the balance of season 3, because we're not sure when we're going to get him back.
Yeah, I mean, when you get the creator of the show on, you take advantage. So yeah. If you're a newbie out there...
There are some spoilers in this here episode. Just be careful, tread lightly, or, you know, skip ahead if you have to.
But you're going to miss a lot of really fracking good stuff if you do.
Yeah, no, he was fantastic. So stay tuned, stick around. Thanks for coming back for the Battle. So go like the guest! Okay, go. Welcome back to the Battlestar Galactica Season 3, everybody. It has been too long since we've graced your ears with our awful, awful voices.
I'm a little hoarse, too.
You're a little hoarse. Well, we both had nights last night. By the time you listen to this, those events won't even be germane to any conversation.
Irrelevant.
So to hell with it. But we're not here to talk about us and what we've been up to. Or maybe we will, but we'll do it later. And you'll hear it first. That'll be fun. But we're here to talk to the creator, executive producer, redefiner of Battlestar Galactica, Ronald D. Moore. Hey, Ron.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Nice to be back.
We are so excited you're back.
Oh, it was good. It was a fun last time.
Excellent. We're glad it wasn't like going to the dentist.
Maybe it was, but somehow we've convinced him to come back.
The pain has faded away.
That's right. The pain has faded.
And so people only ever have more than one child. It's the pain has faded. I don't remember how bad.
Yeah, we didn't ask too soon afterwards.
That's right. It was several months before you questioned.
We went a whole season.
Yes. We're starting the third season with Occupation and Precipice, written by you,
yeah,
Mr. Ron Moore, and directed by Sergio Mimica Gazan.
Sergio.
Yes. But we would be remiss if we didn't do it previously on first to recap the amazing finale of season 2.
Cylons are here.
Well, there's a little bit more than that. There's an election happening.
Baltar is president.
Rosalind tries to steal the election.
Yeah.
I mean, the good girl tries to steal the election and gets caught. Gata, of course, finds out the, he's by the numbers and he finds it out. And
stupid Gata.
But Adama chooses not to.
Right.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you briefly, even though we're going into season 3. Mm-hmm. The choice to, when I was rewatching it again prior to prepping for this, season 3, is it's between Adama and Roslyn. She really should have been put up on charges.
Oh, for the election?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. But, you know.
But hey, we're in war.
We're in war and friends. And he was willing to. It was an interesting moral dilemma for Adama, because certainly what she had done was blatantly illegal. But he understood the reasons why. And he was trying to also move society forward. And what he really wanted was a peaceful transition of power, respect the results of the election, even though we don't like them. And then let's just forget about the rest of this and move on. So he was trying to sort of split the baby a little bit.
Right. There's no good way either direction, because if you put her up on charges, then it's just...
Then that would have caused a whole thing. And it was best in his view to just move on.
Yes.
When we talked at the end of season 1, was the last time you were on, we had talked about the fact that you didn't know really what was going to happen in season 2. And you were like, hey, it's a cliffhanger for everybody concerned. If you want to know network what happens, you got to pick us up and then we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
How much did you know about season 3 when you ended season 2?
Very little. I mean, we didn't come to the idea of New Caprica and that whole storyline until well into the middle of season two. The idea of them stopping and saying, here's a planet that maybe we could settle on was like from the very beginning. That was like an obvious story that you were going to tell at some point. Mm-hmm. And I kind of quickly said, we're not going to do that more than once. I don't want a series of planets that could be the answer to define the show. That was kind of a trap that the original Battlestar fell into. And it was, they did a planet of the week kind of style where, oh, maybe this is where we'll stop. Maybe this. And it just, you kind of wear out your welcome on that kind of storyline early. Mm-hmm. So we said, we will eventually do the story of the planet that could be the place for permanent settlement, but we're going to make a thing of it. And we kept putting it off. And then as we were approaching like the midpoint of season two or thereabouts, we started talking seriously about the dynamics of the election that we had promised way back in season one, where the power players were, the role of Baltar and Roslyn. And we start talking about, we're going to do the election this year. That's coming. Let's start to gear up and think about an election and what that would mean in terms of the society that we've got. And then it became, what's the issue of the election? Beyond the personalities of the two people, what's kind of the issue? And somewhere in that discussion, as we were sort of casting about for big issues, well, the big issue would be, do we stay or do we go if they found like a possible home? So then it kind of became, all right, well, that's going to be the defining issue of the election. So now let's talk about what that planet is like, how long they could possibly stay there. And a lot of that started dictating what season three was going to be as we got deeper into the plotting of the end of season two. Because we kind of said, if we're going to do this, if we're going to go to all this trouble and we're going to have an election that's all about this planet and then Baltar is going to win and then we're going to stay there, it was apparent, at least to me, quickly that it was going to be meaningless if the Cylons showed up, we had to leave like, you know, 2 weeks later or even a month later, because you never had a chance to actually do anything. You never had a chance to colonize the planet to see if that was a stable structure and to give them a shot at actually making a go of it. So that's where the idea of doing the 1 year jump came up at the end of season two, because it was, well, let's give them a real shot. A year goes by and they've had a year to try to, you know, make a go of it on New Caprica, then bring back the Cylons and let's change the game and see what happens. So we kind of had those pieces in place by the time the end of season two rolled around. And the only thing we kind of knew going into season three for sure was that I wanted to drag out how long we could be on that planet as long as humanly possible. The studio and the network were desperate to get us off this planet. It was like, get off there. We want to get back into space. It's not a show about being on Earth. You got to get back into space. And it's so expensive. Oh, the New Caprica sets and the location. It's so expensive. Get out of there. Get out of there. And we just dragged our feet and just strung it out as long. It's why that, you know, we don't get off until Exodus Part 2. We're just kind of pretending that we didn't do a 4-episode arc. You know? It's like, oh yeah, it's 4 episodes. We promised that it was going to be one or two, and then somehow we dragged it out and got 4 out of it.
But there's such rich material.
I know. It was amazing stuff.
Is that what we actually haven't even discussed if we're going to cover it or not yet? But the webisodes, because the webisodes lead into season three, the year that they're there, then they start, you know, they start colonizing, they start settling, and they start having, you know, the chief becomes the union leader. They start having more regular society issues of just day-to-day issues, not day-to-day issues, but as opposed to running from the Cylons. And then, swoop, that's when the Cylons come in.
Yeah, like, right? Life and gets mundane.
Life gets mundane and back to regular world problems, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But this has been 4 months of Cylon occupation at this point when season three picks up.
Right, yeah, 134 days.
And we've, you know, it ties in captivity. He's lost an eye.
So when you had to pitch the actors on like, here's kind of your new status quo, here's what you're doing, what was the reaction from?
I think I avoided actually doing that. I think for the most part, it was just, they got the pages and found out. I'm not sure I called anybody up and said anything in particular for this.
Hey, David, you go tell.
Cause it wasn't really, you know, we weren't killing. It was like, if you're killing a character, then you call him and say, okay, look, here's kind of the deal. Here's the reasons why. And, you know, it's sad and unfortunate, and blah, blah, blah. But if it was just like, okay, what their general character arc was and things that were happening to them, I don't think I told them. I do remember that I think Michael Hogan in particular was surprised by the loss of an eye. And I heard back through the grapevine that Mike was not happy about that. That he had like, you know, your eyes are your tool, actor tools, and I'm losing one. How's that going to be? Now I'm a pirate, and we're going to play this. And I just, it'll be great. I might have had a conversation with him on the phone after he found out, but it wasn't before that.
Yeah, he's imagining the rest of the series with this. It certainly, you have to get used to it. He did, yeah, of course, but there might have been a few bumping into walls.
Yeah, sure.
Or things along the way.
And he's the proto Nick Fury. He should just lean into it.
The proto Nick Fury.
If Sam Jackson can do it, so can you.
But I find the beginning so powerful with all the different, you know, you've got the visuals, the bomb making, the tie in captivity, Ellen sleeping with Cavill, Rosalind reading the scrolls, Adama plotting rescue, Tyrell and Anders part of the resistance. Like you can see so much as.
Like nobody's been idle.
Nobody's been idle.
It was fun. I remember writing the beginning. It was, I do like that style of an opening. I've done it on several episodes over the years. I like just sort of images for a couple of pages of disparate images of cutting between different characters and different stories and not knowing what you're looking at for quite a while, then eventually revealing how all the puzzle pieces come together. And this was a fun one because it was just one thing. I don't think in the writer's room we had a really detailed beat outline on this because I typically, for the episodes that I write, I'll do I like to have a basic sketch of it and then go figure out how I want to do it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this was just sort of stuff I made up on the page of little things. Like in particular, like Ty's eye was not something we decided in the writer's room. It wasn't part of the story. And I knew he was supposed to be in captivity, but as I was writing the scene with him in captivity in the description, I just decided he had lost an eye. Sort of apropos of nothing.
Cool.
And I remember sending an email to David Icke and some of the writers who were also working on other episodes at the time. And I said, okay, fair warning, just so you know, Ty's lost an eye. And they were like, what? I said, yeah, he's lost an eye. And they said, how'd that happen? I don't know yet.
It comes to play later on in the episode, which I won't jump ahead, but really puts Ellen in a bind.
Yeah.
Because it's used, you find out it can be used as a bargaining tool.
Yeah.
Later on. Did you know that when you first were writing it, that you were going to?
No, then it feathered in later. It was just one of those things. A lot of times I like finding something on the page as I'm doing it. There's just an idea will come and you put it in. You're not entirely sure how it's going to pay off. But it was such a big deal that then it stuck in my brain of, okay, I've got to pay this off. This does have to have somewhere to go. And then as I moved downstream, I just found a way to kind of come back to it and make it, you know, and make it a key part of that storyline.
It seems like a lot of this opening, you know, it's about torture in ways. It's about, and the smallest tortures.
Do you know that every time they take you out of this cell, we come in here and we change those little hash marks on your little calendar there you're trying to hide?
You know, it's like Kara, you know, stuck in this room where she's got to pretend to kind of be a good partner. And I'm going to kill this dude, and it's going to happen all over again. Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of Chain of Command.
Yeah, a little bit.
That feeling of, like, how am I going to torture you with just the nature of reality, your reality you're presented with in any given time? How many lights are there? Four lights. Yeah. No, there's three.
It's about powerlessness, you know, what it is to be powerless in the face of power when you have no choices and everything of your life, down to even your little hash marks that were the one little tether to reality that you carved out for yourself, can be controlled and manipulated by people that are more powerful. And part of the game here is to switch up, you know, the audience's sympathies for our people. Now we are the ones under occupation. Mm-hmm. And where does that eventually take you? What are the actions you're willing to take to fight back against power when you are powerless? And the next thing you know, you're strapping, you know, suicide vests onto yourself. And it's sort of like, wait, how do I feel about that now? Now, how do I feel about that when I'm on the other side of that equation, when I'm powerless and I'm looking for ways to express my power?
And so some of that comes into play later in the episode so intensely with all sides of the equation, from Jammer on the police force, when you realize it's him, or, and there's other ones that faces that you know, or the insurgents, to everyone, when you see your friends, mm-hmm. And now you're killing your own people. And it's like, what you will do in, when you're faced with it in extreme circumstances, and how different people and who makes what choice,
mm-hmm.
who chooses to become the police force. And is it just to save their own hide, or is it to, because they think they actually are going to do good, get the centurions off the streets, we'll be softer on our own people. And then they're being, and then they're stuck because then they're being later on again, forced to do things that they didn't sign up for. And it's,
I mean, this
it's
is
devastating to watch.
It
really
is. And it's a show that's, this is one where we'd always talked about during the life of the show that it wasn't a show about answers. It was a show about questions. Mm-hmm. And this was definitely a show about questions. What's the right and the wrong thing to do here? Whose side are you on? What's the moral choice? What's the ethical choice? What, you know, what's good versus evil? And there are no clear answers in any of these situations. Virtually every single one of these situations is riven by, you know, moral conflict and shades of gray and complexities that are not easy to just sort of say, well, obviously this is what you should do in this circumstance. And that was something I thought was really important for the show and for these episodes in particular, was to really blur those lines and have the audience never quite comfortable with what they believed and what they wanted to happen and who they were rooting for and why.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely comes out. And oh, this scene right now that's on with Starbucks. Stabbing.
And Callum makes this weird noise.
Yeah, this gurgle sort of.
It's like this weird chicken cluck gurgle thing. I was like, that's weird.
Oh, what? It's, and this is when I totally just changed thought. But when I first saw her, the difference between what the insurgents and the people on the outside are going, I'm like, he's got her, you know, she's kind of got it. It's all posh and she's in a beautiful, and then you realize the mental.
Oh, that's so psychologically
that she's
damaged.
Going through. Yeah. And especially when they bring in.
Well, I love this little bit too, that she goes back and she eats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After she stabs him.
After she stabbed him. She actually does go back and eat.
It's with like her a handle scene bloody. Hannibal.
Yep.
Wiping her, you know, using the napkin.
I know. It's really nice.
She's like a serial killer at this point. And she kills this dude over and over again. And over again.
Yeah. That's
such a great piece of business.
When he comes back and it's been five times. Mm-hmm. Now
how did Mary take to being the leader of the terrorist cell?
I think she embraced it. She was really interested. I think initially I kind of remember having questions about, well, what have I been doing since the year jump? And okay, I'm a school teacher. I buy that. But what's my role now going mm-hmm. forward? And how do we blend that into the series? And it did feel right that she would become sort of the de facto leader mm-hmm. of the underground movement. And then it was just kind of a question for her of, well, am I balancing that role? You know, how much am I actually teaching? Is that just a cover? And, you know, how much is an active participant in the rest of this?
But she's certainly not as strong-minded as Ty is about, you know, the tactics of the insurgents.
Which was an interesting juxtaposition for the two of them, given their previous conflict, you know, and the declaration of martial law and that whole storyline that happened in season two. Now, to put them on the same side, but to find that, you know, he's just willing to go so much further than she is. And we had always set her up as a fairly, you know, no holds barred, you know, ruthless character at times, but there was still a point where she was unwilling to go that Ty was more than willing to go.
But yet he still tells her she has ice in her veins.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I love that speech. Sometimes I think you have ice in your veins and other times I think you're just a school teacher.
Yes.
I did appreciate her exposition journal.
134th day of the silent occupation of New Caprica. Today is Mars Day. Somehow it seems appropriate to honor the god of war on a day when it feels like perpetual war is the only realistic prospect for us. We've had no contact with Galactica since it left 4 months ago. But I refuse to believe that Adama has abandoned us.
Oh, yes. The exposition journal was a lifesaver, believe me. That came up in post. We were like, okay, wait a minute. Confusion points and what's going on and narrative. And, you know, part of the challenge of when you're doing a structure like this that is so disparate and is jumping around to many storylines and jumps forward through time and lots of different characters. It was all gray on the page. And then you put it together in the editing room and you were getting lost in where we are. Okay, wait a minute. What's happened and where are we? So the device of the exposition diary was invaluable.
It reminded me of that bit in Raiders where it's like, all right, listen, we got to tell Indiana Jones what's happening. How do we do this? How do we lay this pipe? How about just two army guys come in and talk about it for 10 minutes? Yeah. Great.
You got to do what you got to do. The audience wants to understand. They just don't want to be bogged down in it. It's right. Like, you know what? If they're confused and lost, then they're not in the show anymore. So you want to give them the guidance along the way. And a device like that is a simple one that they can kind of go, okay, I'm getting it. Now don't spend a lot of time on it. I'm caught up. Let's move on. Mm-hmm.
I did appreciate that a lot of this particular episode, and we'll get to Precipice, I guess, when we get to Precipice, but what seems to be on the outside is unified fronts, right? Like there's the insurgency, which is all kind of operating together and they've got a plan and they're causing havoc. That's the job. And then the occupiers, which are like, yeah, we're the Cylon. We know what we're doing. We're here to occupy. But even within both of those factions, there's dissent.
Yeah.
Like everybody is not entirely on board with what everybody else is doing.
Right.
Right. You got the so-called hero Cylons trying to, well, as the insurgents get more bold, the Cylons start to,
right.
They're
like reexamining the wisdom of their decision. You know, it's like, well, we came here to, what does Cavill say? We came here to spread the word of God, you know, and an article of faith is fear. We need to spread more fear. And then Caprica and Boomer are like, but no, we made a mistake. Like we're
trying to learn from our mistakes.
We're trying to build a peace.
We're here because a majority of the Cylon felt that the slaughter of mankind had been a mistake.
We're here to find a new way to live in peace. As God wants us to live.
And this particular scene, that's when they're trying to get Baltar to sign an order to execute, right? Mm-hmm. Or is it to round up at this point?
It's to round up. It's to bring more people in. And it's to, they're having a graduation ceremony for the new provisional police force, which, you know, it was watching Watchmen like I've been watching and watching how the police are in masks in Watchmen. I was like, oh. Hey, now that's familiar.
Yeah, and it's, you know, but that was also, we were drawing from what was going on in, during the occupation of Iraq during this time. And a lot of things in this episode were drawn from things that were happening in real time. Mm. And there, you know, the American forces were in Iraq and they were dealing with an insurgency. The insurgency itself was splintered into different factions, even among the Iraqis. The American occupying forces themselves had dissension in what they were doing, what was the intent and why are we here and how long are we going to be here and all that kind of stuff. And there was a new security force being formed in Iraq at the time that started to have to wear masks because their lives were being threatened and their families were being threatened by the insurgents. So a lot of this was drawn, ripped from the headlines, as it were, back in the day, because this was kind of the world that we were all living through. It was this sort of day-to-day, oh my God, what's going on in Iraq? Mm-hmm. And so we were definitely drawing, you know, pieces of that as part of the texture and as part of the storyline for what we were doing.
And I think some of, if I remember correctly from filming, that was definitely, you know, you'd asked earlier, Mark, about how the actors were feeling with some of it. And I know some, it was definitely hard on some to be on the, with what was going on in Iraq and everything like that. And then for them to be playing what you heard on the news was the bad side.
The bad guys, yeah.
You know, and to wrap their heads around it. I mean, such rich storytelling for them to do, but at the same time to kind of wrap their heads around their motivation to do it.
It was a very challenging thing, especially at that moment in time. It was very fraught, and it was, you know, we were definitely pushing the boundaries of what we could do. And it was, let's be on the other side of it. Let's turn our heroes into those people. Let's see our heroes become suicide bombers. Was it like, what are you doing? Is this insane? Are you going to lose audience? People are going to freak out. Is there going to be a huge upheaval about the show kind of thing? To the credit, the network actually never objected. I was prepared. It was one of those things. You put out the script. We hadn't pitched them that idea. And I was prepared for a big, okay, we have to all get on the phone and talk about this kind of moments, which I had come to dread. But there wasn't. They never pushed back on it. They never, it just kind of went away. We had other arguments. How much blood are you showing in the suicide bombing? And it's so dark. And can't there be some fun in it? I mean, it was all the usual arguments I had gone through over the years. But the political aspect of it really never came up, which was kind of shocking in a way. I was grateful. But I wasn't going to bring it up. Mm. I just was surprised that they didn't even want to have the conversation of, to make themselves feel better about it. So I don't know if it just went past them Or they just decided this isn't a fight we want to pick, or they were more in line with the show and they were like, no, this works. And let's just talk about, you know, how much blood we see on camera. But it was not a major of all the fights we had. This was not one of them.
That is insanely surprising.
Isn't it? It really is. It was really surprising. It was like, wow.
Like, did you not get it? Did you read past suicide vests?
We went to the mat on whether, you know, Rosalind and Adama were going to smoke a joint in the went to the mat. People shout. I was shouting, really angry, and had a whole thing. But the suicide bombing never even came up.
Wow. Yeah. That I'm going to choose to believe that they're an incredibly enlightened series of executives.
I choose to believe that. I think that's to their credit, because I thank God we didn't have to fight about that.
Yeah. Because I'm just sitting here trying to figure out how you. I mean, it's a fight that should be won if you have to have that fight, but I don't even know the weapons you bring to bear in that fight beyond it's the right thing for the show.
It would have been a hard conversation. I mean, you know, it was a very conceptual idea, and there was just no, I don't know. I can't even reach back to what my arguments were going to be at the time. I was just braced for it, and it just never came, and I was so happy.
Like, wait, I can unclench my cheeks now?
Yeah, I was like, wow.
Ty, where we are, if you're following along, where we are in the scenes right now is Ty has just joined. He's been released,
right?
But he's now joined the insurgents, the leaders with Tyrell and Anders, and they're plotting the yes. graduation bombing.
Thanks to the power of Ellen Ty's love, he has been released.
Yes, we'll go with that.
We'll go with that. I mean, there are other words we could have used.
You know, and yeah, exactly.
It was the swirl.
The twist.
The alphabet.
I'm so proud I got a Seinfeld reference into this show. And that it was in this context is so twisted and dark, and I love it.
with Anders and Tyrell are a little bit more hesitant, but Ty is... Yeah. Hardcore.
Yeah. They're moderates.
And he's like, if you're working with the Cylons, you're a target. Yeah. And yeah. it's
and like collateral damage is on the table. We're okay with that. Yep. We have to be okay with that.
Yep.
He has an amazing speech later on to Rosin, but I'll wait till we get there, about how he can go there. I mean, not only has he been tortured and in captivity in solitary confinement, but his mindset is military.
Yeah.
Later on, that he says, it's just, it was like, it gave me chills.
It's a great speech.
And it feels like with his eye went his moderation. Like he turned into a hardliner, you know, he's like, you know, send him a message. You work with the Cylons, you're a target. There are no boundaries for the Cylons. There are none for us. You know, collateral damage, civilian casualties, fine. Make it ugly.
When we wanted to see the gradations of feeling among our heroes, you know, who felt what and what would be the differences. What is the difference between Tyrell and Ty? Mm. They're both going to be resistance fighters. They're both against the Cylons. And then, well, okay, but who believes in what and how far are each of them willing to go and in what circumstances? And that became sort of the way to define all the characters' points of view, was how far was each of them willing to go? And that kind of said who that person was. Rosalind's line is a different line than Ty's, is a different line than Tyrell's. And each of them had a different moral, you know, red line in the sand that they weren't willing to cross. And that's sort of, oh, okay, this is who the people are.
Yeah. And I like that Ty is operating still under the hope that Adam is out there. That there is a raptor in orbit that is listening for our signal, and he doesn't have any proof of that. All he's working on is hope and faith.
Yeah, and it was important as we structured it not to cut to the Galactica before any of that. We wanted to be with them, to be unclear what happened to the Galactica, and make the audience impatient, make the audience going, where are they? I want to know. I want to cut. I want to see Adama planning their rescue, and make them really, really wait for it. Mm.
Yeah, you see the snippet at the very beginning in the montage of him plotting with the models in the CIC and then throwing the model across the board, and then that's it, right?
Yeah, and even the differences of belief in Adama.
Because the old man isn't just going to leave us to the Cylons.
The old man left me to the Cylons, Colonel. And if it wasn't for my wife being a royal pain in the ass and refusing to let it go, I would be dead a year now.
And I like
they ran to begin with. Sorry to cut you off. You know, from Anders' perspective, there was people left on Caprica, but Galactica took off with the fleet to save the human race. why wouldn't he be doing that again?
Yeah.
Right?
It's what he does.
It's what he does.
And if it wasn't for my royal pain in the ass wife, nobody ever would have come back to get me.
That's right.
That's how this goes with this guy. Why don't you understand this? You were there!
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We need to spend some time on Fat Lee. Because I was thinking a lot about Fat Lee when we got Fat Thor in Avengers Endgame.
Right.
It's like, you know, again, I've seen this before. All of this has happened before. All of it will happen again. But I remember the backlash against Fat Thor in that.
Was there?
There was, because especially amongst America's increasingly large community was, we understand the use of dramatizing weight gain as a compensation for trauma. Like, that makes sense. People do all kinds of things when they've experienced a trauma to pave over those emotional wounds. One of them is drinking. One of them is drugs. A lot of it is eating, is indulging, is consuming. Mm-hmm. But Avengers Endgame never quite respected that as the trauma it was. It became a joke. It became Tony Stark, out of my way, Lebowski, like, you know.
Yeah.
And it never felt as if Fat Lee was a joke. It felt as if you were playing kind of fair with, here's a dude who experienced a trauma we don't understand yet because we haven't seen Unfinished Business.
Right.
But it was never, it's never comical.
Yeah, we didn't try. You're right. I didn't want to make fat jokes. I wanted, the only time that it was really even said was there's a point in, I don't remember which episode, where Adama does say, get your sorry fat ass out of here or something as a way of waking his son up.
Right.
But that I didn't want it to become like a running gag in the show, because it wasn't about that. It was just, the reason that we did it was actually not that deep. It was, we were looking for things at the end of season two. What are the ways to say time has passed for all the characters? Mm-hmm. And we just kind of went through the list. Adama, mustache. Simple, easy. Eddie will love it. Thank God. Okay, put that one aside. You know, and then we just kind of went through the
Starbucks
rest.
Starbucks
hair, the tattoos with her and Sam, I think, mm-hmm. came over the break. Laura's just a school teacher, so it was a shift of like life for her. And then it was Lee. What do we do to sort of visually, as soon as you see him, time has passed? And we just kind of ran through, as David and I think we were on the sound stages doing something else, and we were just like trying to figure this out. And maybe he's fat, somebody said. It was me or him. And yeah, maybe he's fat. We could do a fat suit. Yeah, well, that's right. And then we started laughing. That'd be funny. Oh, it'll drive Jamie crazy. Yeah. Jamie is so in shape, and Jamie's a bit of a gym rat and looks right. amazing. And it was like, oh, okay, well, let's just take that away from him. And it's kind of a way to punish the actor and have a good story at the same time.
Yeah, the joke was on Jamie,
Jamie, yeah.
But yeah, in these, in Occupation and Precipice, it's really only related, it's when Adama has that confrontation with his son and says, you've gone soft, and he's talking with his ideas, and he's just, you know, taking a step back, and he uses it to point out, he's like, have you taken a look in a mirror?
Right.
And you've gone, and then he says, you know, get your fat ass out of here at the end of it.
You're weak, soft, mentally and physically.
This isn't about me.
You've had 4 months to get your act together. And so far, all you've been able to freaking do is to complain and whine about how hard it is. Well, guess what? It's gonna get a lot harder, do you understand me? I want you to turn around and get your fat ass out of here.
But when Lee is then communicating this to his wife, Dualla, she says, it's not about the weight.
Right.
You have gone soft.
Yeah.
You've been without a war for the last 14 or, you know, a year and a half practically. Mm-hmm. And you're, this is what you are. You're a soldier.
Yeah.
And you're fighting. You're going against this because you don't want to pretend you're like your, you don't want to admit you're like your father.
That's right.
But you're like your father. And that's one of the reasons I fell in love with you. Or that's one of the reasons I married you. And it's like, to me, that was one of the reasons that you guys made him put on the fat suit, was to show that he doesn't know what to do with himself when he's not, you know, actually commanding something, doing something, sending, you know, caps out to be, or, you know, squadrons out and things.
Well, that's, and we kind of retrofitted that too. We decided visually, here's what we want to do. Oh, this is fun. It's kind of funny. Mm-hmm. And then it was, the next conversation was, well, but why? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Because we can't, you didn't want to just do it for no reason. Then what does it symbolize? And then it became, oh, he's growing soft. He's lost his edge. And this is the dramatization of it. And then, oh, okay, now I get it. Now it is part of the character and it is a reason to do it in the show. It just started, a lot of these things start from prosaic reasons. There's a production reason to do something. There's a budgetary reason. We got to make some change. And then you find depth and meaning to the change that you've made. It's a, you know, going all the way back to the start of the show when we were trying to figure out how to dramatize the Cylons on camera. And we were stuck with the production reality of we couldn't make enough suits to really be viable on television. And we couldn't do completely CGI characters at that point on television. Well, what if we make them look human? Okay, well, that solves our production problem. But what does it mean? Why are they human? And that opened up a huge bit of mythology of the show and became one of the fundamental underpinnings of what we were doing, of why the Cylons looked human. But it came from a very prosaic place of just solving a production problem. Same thing with the Lee in the fat suit. It was like, okay, how does he look different? And you find this funny idea, but then you have to give meaning to it. Okay, well, why and what's underneath that? And then that becomes his storyline.
I did appreciate the slight dig at the end of Dualla's little run there. It's like, you know, you're more like your father than you like to admit. It's why I married you. It's like, you would have married my dad? Like, if he was like 10 years younger and I was 10 years old, he wasn't my boss, like I'd have made a run for it.
You're kind of second choice.
But you've seen all along that Dualla has such a respect for the old man, right? Yeah, like it's...
That was a key thing for her.
Yeah. This scene, we just passed that scene actually where Adama tells his son he's gone soft. But this sequence here with Duck and the idea to send that he's going to be the suicide bomber going into the graduation ceremony. Mm-hmm. The choice that it's him, that, you know, he's lost his wife and that he's volunteered. And this whole sequence of everybody kind of accepting him and then seeing Duck and seeing... I think there's a couple of scenes in between, but then seeing Duck prepare.
Yeah.
And the image that really stuck for me was when he gets the suit, he gets the vest on, everything, and he looks at himself in the mirror one more time and the mirror's cracked.
Yeah.
And his face is kind of cracked in half. And I was just like,
yeah, that's great. Mm.
I appreciate, I also like this whole run here with Sharon and Adama, where like in the year and a half since we've seen them last, she's kind of, you know, there's a couch and there's a coffee table. And clearly Bill spends a lot of time here because he no longer has any confidants, really. Like his XO is Hilo, who, you know, he likes fine, but doesn't particularly trust. Mm-hmm. His son has turned soft and Stay Puft Marshmallow Lee. And and she's the closest he's got to an intimate, really.
Yeah.
And and the conversation that they have about guilt, about his unwillingness to reckon with his own guilt.
Of leaving them.
And her sort of holding him to it. Like it's a pair of scenes of these women telling these Adama men, here's your problem. Here's a thing you need to steer into.
Yeah.
And it's like, we can't make it out of here unless you find a way to forgive yourself for what you've done.
You know, I don't think we can survive. I don't think the fleet or Galactica or the people on New Caprica can survive unless the man at the top finds a way to forgive himself.
I also liked what it said. I mean, you touched on that Adama needs a confidant. I thought that was an interesting thing of the character too, that You know, a lot of times that role is the loner, you know, the loner commander that, you know, no one understands his troubles and he doesn't really need anybody. And then you slowly find out that there's a human being underneath the facade anyway. But from the beginning, we always played Adama as a man who had confidants and needed them. Mm. It was Ty, it was Douala. There were people that he let inside and he was vulnerable with and he could talk to in very vulnerable terms as family, you know, all the way through. And that, yeah, in this circumstance, he had to find that person. Mm. And it was Sharon, which was sort of the interesting, interesting choice that of the people that were left on Galactica with him, he couldn't have those conversations with anybody else. And he chose her to have these sort of intimate heart to hearts in the dead of night sort of conversation. So I thought it was, I always liked that aspect of Adama, that he wasn't quite the just, you know, chisel jawed loner that you usually play for this kind of character.
Is there a little bit of a recklessness to it, subconscious recklessness to it for him to reach out to Sharon, who obviously is a Cylon, who the other model boomer shot him, like the trust level, right? And she asks him this when he's about to send her off. Why do you trust me? And he says, I don't, but that's what trust is about.
Yeah.
And, or how do you know you can trust me? Well, I don't, but that's what trust is about. But sort of a recklessness in him choosing her as a confidant, that if she turns, that it's kind of off his hands in some way, because it's, yeah. How could, you know, he kind of has to trust her because she's really the only one that has a chance of getting in and infiltrating without being seen, you know, or known. That it's, I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say, but it just kind of struck me when you were talking about that, that is there something in it in his subconscious that's, I'm going to put my faith in her because I think A, I don't have a choice, and B, maybe it will absolve me of some guilt.
I think there's also a vanity to it, in honesty. I think there's a vanity to Adama that likes the idea that I see what others don't sometimes, and I, you know, that I will take the crazy risk that other people think is insane, and then I think he does pride himself on that to a certain extent, and that can be, you know, a flaw and a trap for him as well, because Adama is not without ego and he is not without vanity, and I think part of that is his belief that he can always read people and that he sees the inner truth sometimes when other people don't. And so, and that can catch him short.
And she is, of everybody he's met, I think, at least in the last definitely year and a half, if not longer, she's never lied to him.
Right.
Like it has always been front street with her. I showed up a Cylon. You knew I was. I never said that I wasn't. I'm carrying this baby. Here's where it came from. Like, I'm not the same Sharon that shot you. I'm like, she's always been candid.
And they've actually lied to her
all the time
with Hera being still alive.
Yeah. So it never seemed like a crazy stretch for him to find a way to trust somebody who's always been above board with him. But it's interesting to see that he would, you know, and that's who he chooses.
Yeah.
Not his family, not his soldier under his command.
Well, it in a way, though, it is, he always does revert to his family. And it's sort of the family that we started with at the beginning of the series. It's a different Sharon, but it's still Sharon on some weird level. And Adama, I think, has always kind of gotten a little bit lost in the Sharons and the, you know, the multiples, and he still kind of reverts to who they were at the beginning. And I think he always thought of Sharon and Tyrell and that core crew that was on the Galactica before she was going to be retired as family on some level. He always wants to forgive Sharon, just like he always wants to forgive Tyrell, because they are family to him, you know, and there's this need to sort of find a reason to forgive and to always bring them back in, no matter how far a field they've gone. He always kind of reverts to that family unit. Well, they're still my children. I'm still going to find a way to love them somehow, some way.
Yeah, Ty has that line in the second season. It's like, you look at it and you still see that fresh-faced rookie pilot.
Yeah.
Who showed up on the deck and she's not that.
Yeah.
But he will always believe
that. He always sees that. He always believes. Same with Starbucks. Same with Ty, you know? Mm. That's why ultimately the Ty revelation was so particularly devastating to him, because of all the players, he was probably the closest to Adama as terms of family, other than Lee. It was like there was Ty, you know? And then Ty turns out not to be what he thought. And that's the breaking point for Adama, really.
How far into season three, did you know who was going to be?
Oh, not until very late. That wasn't until we were dealing with the end of season three, and we were literally, we were breaking the finale for season three, which was the trial of Baltar. We had structured the season at this point when we were doing these Occupation Precipice. We had a sketch of the of where it was generally going. We knew that the New Caprica storyline and the post fallout of people trying to deal with the aftermath of something like this was going to consume basically the first half of the season, and that we'd take Baltar off on the Cylon ship, and that would be a whole story. And we just said, and eventually we're going to get Baltar back, and they're probably going to put him on trial. And okay, probably the end of the season is the trial of Gaius Baltar. And we kind of just put a pin in that and said, that's where all these storylines are eventually going to take us. It wasn't until we got to breaking the actual finale that I came in the room, and I think the staff had been breaking some of it without me, and they were presenting the trial of Baltar, and I just kind of felt instinctively that it just wasn't enough. Like, we didn't have certainly it wasn't as great an ending as what we'd had last season. Like, on some level, I fell into the trap of wanting to top yourself. You're like, oh, we did the year jump last season. Well, what are we going to do this season? You know, and that's really a trap for storytellers. You try not to buy into it, but it's hard not to. And
you want
to,
Adama wanna, being shot.
Yeah.
Then the year jump and the Cylon occupation.
We had some big moves. And the trial of Baltar, especially the ending, which was that he was going to be not guilty, felt like it was going to end with a whimper instead of a bang. And it was a good story, but it was suddenly a legal show at the end, and it didn't feel like it had teeth to it. It wasn't as surprising as you wanted it to be. And I remember being in the writer's room and just saying, I don't know, it just feels like we need something bigger. We need a bigger move here. You know, what if, you know, we could reveal a Cylon. Somebody said, yeah, I know, we've done that before. Is that the thing? And I said, maybe we just, I want like five of them to come out. Like five of our characters walk in a room and look at each other and go, we're Cylons, right? Yeah, we're Cylons. And there's only five, and maybe we only reveal four of them. And they all just like look at each other. And then that just changed the conversation in the room. We all started going, well, who would it be? And then within that same session, I'm pretty sure, memory's always a little foggy, but as I recall, we, within that session, literally went through the entire cast and said, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And Ty and Tyrell were the two most controversial of whether we were going to go down that path with either of them or both of them, and what it would mean to the show, what it meant to those characters, what were we saying about everything that we had been doing and where we were going, and went round and round for a while. But eventually we all kind of realized that because they were such big characters, they were going to have the most impact. There's the shot of the mirror you were talking about with Duck on the show right now.
Oh, yes.
But that was, it wasn't until we got to that point that we started talking about Ty. Yeah.
For those of you new listeners, there's a few spoilers.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's my fault if it's anybody's fault. But you know what? At this point, season three, our relationship to spoilers, which is...
This show's 15 years old.
It kind of is. Yeah. So, like, I feel you, new viewers who are, you know,
watching. We generally try to avoid this.
We try to avoid them. And we'll do a warning at the top.
Okay. We'll do a warning at the top.
We'll go back and we'll say, yeah. So even though you're now listening in line, we warned you.
But we only have Ron Moore every so once in a while. So we need to get everything we can.
If we're going to go deep, we're going to go deep.
Yeah. Now, this with Duck, seeing the whole sequence building up, for me personally, seeing the whole sequence of it building up, him preparing, knowing he volunteered, seeing this, and then the aftermath when you see the number of bodies, and it's
devastating.
It's devastating.
It's a pretty hard. This is a pretty hardcore sequence. I am a little surprised we did this looking back. I mean, it's really, but it was, again, I remember us talking about it internally, even though we weren't arguing with the network about it. Internally, there was a lot of like, okay, are we sure? And how far are we going to go? And what are we saying? And there was a definite passion in the writer's room and among on the show in general that this was such a huge thing that was actually happening to real people that you wanted to play it real. You didn't That's want it to be easy. You didn't want it to be, oh, and just a couple of people were hurt. It was like people were really dying by this. And if we were going to do a storyline that incorporated it, let's play it as truthfully as we can. It is ugly. It is messy. It is devastating and horrible in a lot of ways. So don't shy away from that.
And that's exactly what I meant by that. It's devastating because it's happening.
Yeah.
It's not it's like it's this is just thing. Fiction. Mm. And I mean, this is fiction, but it is really happening. And it hits you to the core because, you know, some of the people have in real life have friends that are in that room and still the ones that let the bomb go off or, you know, it's
devastating all the more so because it's futile. Like the entire purpose for this was to kill Baltar.
It
was about killing Baltar. That's it's right. Like as long as if Baltar is going to be there, you go ahead. If he's not going to be there, abort.
And you see that whole chase with Gaeta with putting the secret informant. And then you find out it's Gaeta, right? And he's trying, and you see the dog bowl not be flipped over in time. Tyrell looking at it, Andrew's looking at it. It's not flipped over. Gaeta gets there just as they've turned away, and it's like it's all futile because. Of that, because
it's just timing. Like timing. Two ships in the night just didn't dock when they were supposed to dock, and they blew up 25 some odd innocent civilians.
And this scene, this Baltar Laura scene, was one of my favorite scenes in the episode and in the show. Really, overall, this was a really interesting beat of role reversal, really, between the two of them, of Baltar coming in and having the moral high ground over Laura for a change, and Laura being forced into the other position and really having the audience, like I said earlier, not sure who I'm rooting for in this scene and feeling really uncomfortable with the conversation and realizing that they're both, arguing positions that have validity and you're really uncomfortable with both of the positions that they're arguing. It was sort of, this is like one of the high points of the show is this kind of, and it's just a scene of two people sitting in chairs talking, there's nothing more spectacular going on there. And it's carried by the ideas of the scene and the performances of the two actors.
Yeah. There's two things in this scene that struck me. There's the, him handing her the glasses back and his hand is shaking. Like he's nervous to be in that room.
Yeah.
And then he says to her, let me help you, Laura, in ways I cannot help myself. That he is he's as trapped by this as anybody else. And nobody sees that about him.
I think the glasses might have been something Mary suggested in my recollection. I think she might have come up with the thing that she didn't have her glasses and then Baltar would bring them to her. I think that was something. Because Mary would, like, every once in a while, she would have notes or want to discuss scenes with the character ahead of time. And I think I had a conversation with Mary about this and that she suggested that, and that then that got worked into the script.
Yeah. Like, it's so much of this is about individuals' perspectives on themselves in this scenario.
Yeah.
And while he doesn't believe himself to be the hero, I don't think, Baltar believes himself to be as much a victim of this occupation as anybody else does. And the tragedy of him here is that nobody else understands that.
Yeah, he does see himself as a victim. He totally does. And there's validity to that and to that point of view as well.
You certainly see him.
He's trapped.
He's trapped completely. He's
totally trapped.
And there's a scene coming up where he literally is trapped.
Yeah.
Where it, with the execution, signing the execution order. He dies or he signs.
Yeah.
And there's not that many people.
No. We all say the thing, oh, I would never do it. I'd let them. Really? Would you? Would you really? When they have the gun pressed to your head, would you really? Like, very few of us are capable of that kind of enormous courage in that moment.
Yeah. And Baltar has never been that person.
It's not who he is.
Yeah. He's about his own self-interest. And at that moment.
But, in defense of him, and I think James felt that point very strongly, was he wants very badly to be that guy in that moment and that James wanted to play the character struggling and really see the struggle of him, with the gun against his head and the tension of it. And before he breaks, like he is going to break and he is going to sign it, but he really wanted to play it out that it wasn't easy for him to do it. He wouldn't just do it because they said they would shoot him or that they were threatening him. It had to go all the way to the gun to his head and his eyes popping out and just really, he had to feel the threat of mortality in the moment in order to get there. And I think that was a valid point.
And Doral, I never know if it's Doral or Doral.
I always played it both ways.
Yeah, I know.
I don't think there's a correct.
Doral. Shooting Caprica.
Yeah.
Like right over his head. Like, and boom. If you've ever had a gunshot right over your head, like I've never had one pointed at my head and then shot directly over my head at my lover, my,
yeah,
you know,
like it, right there,
right there. And even though, you know, she's going to be back,
yeah,
it's still so visceral, yeah, and shocking, and just his ears would be ringing. Oh, and yeah.
The reality, it's right here, the blood, the smell of the cordite and the fresh blood pooling on the ground. And she was alive right here next to me.
Defending him. Defending as well. Him.
And now she's dead and they're threatening to do it to me. And that would, you know, tip him over the edge.
And then Headsick shows up.
And then Headsick.
Yeah.
Headsick has been gone for a while. I was watching and I was like, oh, yeah, she's hey, back.
Me. Hey, me, it's the real me.
Yeah. But she says something to get him to, you know, something to effect of sometimes you have to do things you don't want to survive another day or something. Yeah. Something I have it written down somewhere, but to get him to finally sign the.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember what her line is.
But yeah. I have it somewhere. It's in your, when I reach it, I'll
get, it's in your copious notes.
It's in my handwritten scribble. Yes.
Like a doctor you are with that.
Anyway.
Yeah. And I kept feeling, I mean, as I was supposed to, both ambivalent and sad for Jammer. Because Jammer just wanted to do the right thing. You know, like, isn't it better if the Cylons aren't like roaming through here? Isn't it better if we can be a little softer and they're going to police us? Couldn't we police us safer?
And yeah. You see him talking to Chief, whose wife, Callie, who was his, you know, they all work together. They're best friends. And you see, she's been taken away from her baby, and he's just stuck.
Yeah.
And Chief's like, do you know any of them? You know, you have names. And he's just lying through his teeth, but just the pain in his eyes.
One day, when this is all over, guys like Gaeta are going to get strung up. Guys like you and me, we're going to be there, tying the knots.
We wanted to feel sympathy for and at least understand people who had made his choice. Mm. People, you know, what were they have this police force. Well, who's joining it and why? And what are they trying to do? And what's in it for them? And to sort of have a bit of empathy for, well, they're trying to do the best they can in this circumstance and making the choice. Well, maybe it is better that we police ourselves and maybe that'll help the situation. And before you know it, you're like helping the Cylons, you know, and it's hard, but there are little choices you make along the way. Yeah. And here's the thing with the masks and all that. Yeah.
Can you walk us through a little bit the... the timeline, the deciding the timeline about when the audience would discover that Gaeta was Deep Throat and when our characters would discover that Gaeta was Deep Throat, because you reveal that twist relatively early on.
Right.
Like, you kind of could have played the mystery of who was feeding us this information for a couple of episodes if you wanted to. But you get it out almost two scenes into the Deep Throat storyline, two or three scenes.
I think we did that in part for Gaeta, because we wanted the audience, I wanted, you know, what's his story? And if you didn't know that, then he seems to just be blithely helping Baltar. And you'd kind of wonder, well, why is he just so blindly helping Baltar? What's then didn't seem like as interesting a story. And also, I think, as I recall, once you said there is a Deep Throat and we haven't revealed who it is, you kind of naturally started thinking, well, maybe it's Gaeta anyway. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't going to give us a lot of super mystery because there weren't a lot of suspects, really, of who it could be. It's probably not one of the Cylons. So who then would it be of humans? Well, it's really probably Gaeta or it's Baltar. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the primary reason was it gave us more tension. It gave more tensions in the scene. Every time Gaeta was in a scene, you knew he was playing a double role. So that was interesting. And it just deepened Gaeta's character for where we were going. Mm.
Why didn't he just tell Chief, like, I'm the guy. I'm the one.
Yeah, because
don't it was, be such an asshole to me.
The whole thing was set up to be like, you know, double blinds, and they're not supposed to know, so that if someone's caught, they can't, you know, turn the table on somebody else. So it was sort of the classic terrorist cell ideas, and they never reveal who they are so that they always have deniability and they can never actually like betray somebody else.
Yeah.
Oh.
God, I love it. I did appreciate seeing Cat become the CAG.
Yeah, that was great.
And Racetrack take on the role in the Raptors, right? The kind of command role.
Well, and it was great because the show had grown and matured to the point where we literally had players that could step up. We had characters that we had established and the audience knew. Then in this circumstance, they just moved forward. We didn't have to invent whole new characters and introduce them to the audience. Mm-hmm. There's a satisfaction and a joy to seeing people that you've followed as small as what started out as small characters that grow over time, and suddenly they're sort of front and center in a situation like this, because it all feels organic to the show and it all feels real. And you have investments in these characters. You care about who Kat is, and you care about whether she can pull this off, and you're rooting for her, and you wonder and you worry, and you're hoping that she doesn't die in the conflagration. So it's really great, as opposed to a new guest star who steps in mm-hmm. to be the new Keg, who you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. Now here's a new actor, and do I care about them, or do I just assume they're dead because they're a new actor? And it's, you know, there's ways of pulling the audience deeper and deeper into a story like this, but we couldn't have done this like season one. You know, we couldn't have done any of this storyline in season one because we hadn't gotten to know the characters as deeply. We hadn't spent time with them, and we didn't have the second rank of people that would come up and fill all those roles.
That's one thing I think you guys did and Battlestar, you know, did very well, is utilizing everybody that you said you've gotten to know over the time, instead of bringing some people in, because you don't often see that in large ensemble shows. And I know it frustrates the actors. I have a friend going through it right now. Like, why am I here? But it's so much richer for the audience than to just have new faces come in or have this large ensemble, but then really only see a couple of faces all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it brings such a history to it and heart to it.
It was great.
You guys did that really well.
Thank you. And it was really important to us. And it was a joy to do it. And there were a lot of reasons why. Some of it was the uniqueness of our concept, because there were only, you know, 20,000-40,000 survivors. You were kind of telling the audience right away, there's not a huge world out there. So you were sort of, the more you saw familiar faces over and over again, the more it reinforced that idea that there wasn't just an infinite pool of people that would magically appear out of nowhere. So that made you conceptually try to keep it relatively within familiarity. If there's a new storyline, who of our characters can we work into it, as opposed to bringing up a brand new character every time? Yeah, the other thing was just, we were blessed with such great casting and such a great ensemble of players that there was no such thing as a small role. And we, the writers, would constantly, we'd write little things for a character and we would see it. And then we would be inspired to write something else for that character and something else and something else, until you've built a full blown character without really intending to do that from the outset.
Now we're, just on a more business aspect of it, most shows that have such large casts, there's not all the cast that are on the payroll, so to speak. They're supporting, or, you know, there's leads, there's recurring, and then there's guests, right? And small recurring. I would imagine not everybody was under like a series deal or a recurring deal, but because the material was so rich and the characters were so good, I don't think it was probably hard to get these people to come back. But you're at a little bit of a guessing game sometimes, right? Oh, is somebody that we're going to be writing for going forward, say Kat, for example? I'm not saying it was Kat, but is she going to be available?
Absolutely.
Because if we don't have her under a series deal, is she going to then get another show and be gone? And then you have to adapt if that happens.
Yeah,
right?
you were always taking a risk, because you're absolutely right. You couldn't afford to sign them all up to series deals. You just couldn't. So there's the different strata of how that is. People that are all episodes produced, and some people are, you know, 7 out of 10 or whatever, and then there's recurring and so on. And you do the best you can. You know, we probably got a little overconfident in our ability to bring people back after the first season. Some of it was, we were shooting in Vancouver. And yes, Vancouver was a busy town with a lot of productions going on, but it wasn't a vast amount of production going on. There was still enough flexibility that we felt fairly confident that our Vancouver players would probably be available to us later. And if they weren't, we could probably work out the schedule with somebody.
Right.
So we got kind of familiar with the Vancouver acting pool and a feeling that we could take the risk, and that probably 9 times out of 10, we were going to be able to make it work out one way or the other.
And they were going to do their damnedest as well to make it work because of the material.
Right. They wanted to come back, and that was a big thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like Callum Keith Rennie,
who's amazing.
Who's amazing, but we could never, we always wanted to sort of nail down Callum to sort of, okay, X number of, and Callum was always, I'm not really, well, just talk to me when we get there. And then we would get there and hold our breath and he would find a way to work it out, you know? So it always did work out.
This with bringing Casey in, Leopold bringing Casey in.
Yeah, that was weird.
It's just such a mind so crack.
What was that pitch in the room like?
That was, I don't even, I think it came, we were trying to just structure out that story of the craziness. I loved the isolation and the weird little thing that was happening in that world between Leopold and Kara, because we had always set them up. There's something between these two. And we're going to play that to the end. We kind of knew. All right, well, what's the next twist in this? She kills him. He keeps coming back, and that's amazing and great. But we can't keep doing that over and over. He has to like up the game. And what would that be? And we talked about all kinds of crazy shit. We were going to bring a Cylon Zach in the room at one point. We were going to. It was like you just start throwing ideas out, and then there was the baby. And is it her baby? And how could that be? And who is this baby? And that we had no idea what the answer was, but we loved that as soon as he came in with it, it was like, oh, well, that's a game changer. Let's figure out what that means, you know?
And I love the change of like her bringing, she's down, you know, in the living room area, and he's bringing her down, this angelic looking child. And there's a possibility it's her. She doesn't know that.
She doesn't know.
That one of her eggs wasn't harvested.
And we don't know.
The story checks out.
The story checks out. It looks like her. And then when you see them again, now he's Callum and Casey are down and she's on the stairwell looking through the grate of the railing.
She's finding walls.
She's finding walls to put between them. And I thought that was interesting filming of it.
And we did debate whether it was going to be her child or not. More spoiler alerts, but yeah, we did, we did debate extensively the possibility of that it really was her child and where that was going to go. And we went down a few branches of, and then the child dies somehow in Exodus. And that's a tragic end of the story. It really is her child. And then she takes it to the Galactica and she's trying to raise it. And then at first we thought let's do that, 'cause it's so unexpected for Starbuck. And then just realized that was going to so completely dominate her story from that point forward that it felt like, well, it just swamps her story. It was hard to play much else that wasn't attached to that. And we were like, I don't think we want to change the character so much. And then, well, it's really twisted if it's just not even hers. Like she's just gotten to the point of acceptance and she's just risked her life and she's just willing to, and then it's like, oh, no, it's not yours after all.
And you see it even in this where, you know, she's pushing the child away, she's locked herself in the bathroom and then she hears the fall. And I was like, didn't Leopold actually push the kid? Is he in there somehow push the kid?
Oh, we had that discussion too. Yeah. Like, is he doing this to his kid? He?
Yeah. And then you see her, you know, over the hospital bed, you know, the bed, trying to really willing this child, praying for this child to survive because of the guilt. And also it's a child, like, you know, like you've pushed away the child, even if it's yours or it's not, or whatever, you're in care of this tiny thing. And Leoben's, when she's praying and Leoben puts his hand on her shoulder and it's the first time you don't see her flinch or do anything. And then the child opens her eyes and Kara puts her hand on the child's and puts her hand on Leoben's hand. Like he's moved his hand now onto the bed and she puts her hand in, you know, inadvertently and then you're feeling this and you're like, oh shit, his mind game is working.
It's working.
It's a perfect torture.
Well, that was the great thing too, because we wanted it to be, Leoben is smart too. And yeah, it's her indomitable spirit and will to survive versus his indomitable will to conquer her somehow. And how do you make both of those sides valid? And that this introducing the child into the equation would be the wild card that she never saw coming. And how could she deal with that? And it would speak to so many things of Kara, her own twisted life, her own childhood, her own sense, her own traumas and loss and all those kinds of things and feelings of guilt. And that there is a tie. There is something. He has been trying. He's been saying all the right things over and over and over again for so long. And that starts to work on you psychologically. And she's not paying attention to that part anymore. She's not really thinking about the Leoben part of this as much as she's just inexorably drawn towards thinking about the child. And the next thing you know, he can put his hand on her and she's not flinching and she can actually reciprocate.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
It gave me, it didn't give me the heebie-jeebies. It didn't creep me out. It was just kind of, I mean, I got sort of mad, but it also was, it's this touching moment too. Yeah. And
it plays very organically.
It does. Yes.
And she's been gone for like almost the entirety of this 134 days, right? Like
she's in complete isolation. She's just totally locked in this world with him. And he's dying over and over again. And she's just in a weird psychological space that is, you know, it's solitary confinement by another name. I mean, she's just not connected to the rest of the world. So her actions and her psychology are just very, very different than everyone else. This is that Adama Lorisin you were talking about. Ty Lorisin, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it when she hits him.
It's so good. Oh, and like she apologizes for it immediately. Oh.
And then he has this amazing... Chief goes, we have to decide which side we're on because he's wanting to do more suicide bombings. And she's saying, you know, no, right? Mm-hmm.
Which side are we on? We're on the side of the demons, Chief. We're evil men in the gardens of paradise sent by the forces of death to spread devastation and destruction wherever we go.
I know. It's just all the way. He's all in.
He's all in.
Just sitting there smoking his little tiny cigarette.
Yeah. I love it. It's just amazing.
Is it this scene too where he says, or is it another scene where I was saying earlier, he has this great speech to Roslyn about she's like, I can't remember how she sets it up, but then he's like, I've gone through two wars. Yeah. I've sent men on suicide missions.
Yeah, be they in the cockpit of a Viper or with a bomb strapped to their chest.
Yeah, what's the difference? Right. Like, it's just...
This is his...
It's heavy.
This is his I'll never wear a life jacket again.
It is. It is. And it's really defining of the character in a lot of ways. And it's setting up the stakes of it all and the, you know, how you get to this place and what you have to believe in. And it's just an amazing performance by Michael. I mean, he just so embraced this whole notion of the character and just, he's completely believable.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, this is that place.
And the cane helps so much.
The cane, the eye patch, the stocking cap is a nice touch.
Yeah. He's a brilliant actor. I know. Love
he's my... really great. He's really something. He was a special part of this show.
He had this, I'm not even going to try and reiterate it, but Mary moderated a panel at a Pensacola, Florida there was like seven of us, I think. And Michael had this amazing, Michael Hogan, because Michael Trucco was there as well, had this amazing story of All Along the Watchtower. And hearing that, the song, I mean, that's the song that was playing, right? When he was hearing. And, I won't recount it, but I'll try and find it somewhere because I know we filmed it. Somebody filmed
it. His impression of what it was like for him to read it or what?
Yeah, and I'll find it and send it to you because there was this entire story. He went on for about 5-10 minutes talking about the relevance of this and this. It had been like one of his favorite songs.
Oh, really?
And like, yeah, all along. And he's seeing it in the script and then it was
a
brilliant story that I'd never heard before.
Yeah, I haven't heard that.
Yeah, I'll find it and get it for you.
I like how Kara's story, even though it is separate and isolated and discreet from everybody else's, is a microcosm of the rest of the stories.
Yeah.
Right? It's that, you know, she is under occupation and she is rebelling against that occupation and it's been futile for a long while until there's some quantum shift in the nature of that reality, which is now the kid, you know, and the quantum shift on the outside world is we're suicide bombing. And like, how do we respond to that? And that response is going to change the nature of this particular precarious.
And who am I? You know, who am I? What do I believe? Who do I want to be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who can I be?
Uh-oh.
Baby down.
They're going to call Dyfus. Child services. Carrie, you killed a baby.
Oh, to see the blood there, the little bit of blood. Under
I know. It was just like, whoa, the show isn't dark enough. It's like, let's take another step in that direction.
Yes. Well, I mean, you got to up yourself. You killed a toddler in the miniseries.
I know. Where do you go from there?
You killed an infant there.
This now is you nothing, just, man.
Come on.
There was no blood there. That was just
a sound.
The debate of how loud to make the crack, right?
Oh my God!
Although I remember, was it you saying last time that the network had, there was big discussion on if the baby killing in the beginning was going to be allowed or not.
Yeah, they hated it.
Yeah. And,
and then there was like, they said, they kept coming back to it. You know, when they did the infamous testing of the show, that was horrific. It was like, and that was singled out as a thing that everyone in the test audience hated. And then after it was on the air and it was a success and we were still in the, okay, we're going to go to series conversation, they still bothered to go back and say, and, you know, just so you know, the ratings, when she did that, the ratings dropped. Like, okay, you've made your point.
And it's funny because somebody just the other day was asking when we were starting back up again and said, you know, one of the pivotal moments for them in the miniseries was when you saw that.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, this is not going to be what I was expecting.
Yeah.
Freaking drawn.
It set a tone and like, oh, wait a minute. They're not kidding around here. They're really going to go some places.
Yeah. It was when I was all in.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is this show.
You're like, whoa, cool. Wait a minute. They're not pulling any punches here.
Yeah. And I don't remember if we had talked about the last time you were here, but the one and only time I met Stephen King was I was working for Entertainment Weekly. And I was the Battlestar guy. That was my beat. And so I'm sitting in my office. And Stephen King had written a column for Entertainment Weekly called The Pop of King. And we would always joke, like, is he ever going to come to like a meeting, a staff meeting, and hang out with us? I was like, no, it's fucking Stephen King. He's not going to do that. One day was visiting his publisher in Manhattan, and he just dropped by the office. So I'm sitting in my office watching Battlestar, and I look over my shoulder, and Stephen King is standing in my doorway and had been for like 10 minutes. I'm like, hey. He's like, hell of a show, right? I'm like, yeah, I know. I was like, they killed that baby? I'm in. It's like, all right. And he stood for another 10 minutes and then walked on.
Really?
I was watching something. It was the Pegasus episode, I think.
Oh, yeah?
And he was just stood there. Huh? Bye, Stephen King. Good to kind of meet you a little bit, Stephen King. We know that you have to run, that you have a bit of a heart out.
I do.
So I think we can wrap the Ron Moore portion of this podcast. But what are you working on? What's happening in the life of Ron Moore? What has changed since last we spoke to you?
We're in the middle of season two of For All Mankind at this point. Mm-hmm. We're almost halfway through shooting of the second season, which is great and fun. Season one of the show took you from 1969 into like 1974. And then the second season, we're jumping into the 80s. So it's going to be the part of the fun of structurally of this show is watching the space program and watching the world change over time. So it's kind of a multi-generational story. We're going to keep moving ahead, you know, further and further into the future of this alternate history story that we're doing. And it's really fun. So now you're sort of doing 80s stuff and you got 80s clothes going and we're starting to talk about music and it has a whole different vibe to it than season one did. It's really fun. It's exciting.
That's cool. Yeah, and the last time you were here, the show hadn't come out yet.
Right.
What was your experience of releasing this into the world, being one of Apple's flagship shows and that entire process?
It was fun, exhilarating, and sort of weird at the same time because there was a lot of attention because there were a lot of things that were reviewing the platform as opposed to us. There was a lot of just like Apple and talking about Apple as opposed to talking about our actual series. And we had good reviews. And then there were some reviews that didn't get the show, which you always, you know, just people that don't get it. But the audience response has been very strong. People that watch the show keep watching. You know, that's the great thing. It was like people that sample the show tend to keep moving on and will keep watching multiple episodes and become really dedicated fans, which is a great thing that Apple wants to see and that, you know, as a creator, you want to see. It's like, if you can get them in the door, you want to keep them. And we were able to keep like the lion's share of people that would come in and try the show.
Oh, that's awesome. Are they, I mean, I'm assuming that they do share some semblance of viewer data.
Somewhat,
creators.
You know, not numbers. They talk about the way I'm talking in general terms. Here's like they'll give you, you know, here's the trend line, and you know, more people, you know, percentages of how many people would watch past the first 10 minutes, you know, stuff like that, but not actual numbers of raw data of X number of users watching on this platform and that. And hey, okay,
right.
Whatever. They have their own internal privacy concerns and competitiveness with Netflix doesn't share that and we don't want to share. Yeah, I don't care. You know, just tell me because I don't really care about the numbers. I just want to know, do people like it? Are they sticking with this? Am I coming back for another season? Okay.
Can I make more of it?
It's like a 5-minute meeting. I don't really need an hour beyond that. It's like, okay, that's all I need to know.
Well, congratulations on the first season of that.
Thank you.
So excited that you get to do more of it because it's pretty fantastic.
I'm enjoying it. I really enjoy the show. I think it's really fun and different and interesting.
Awesome.
I just got Apple Plus. Now I can watch.
Good. There Yay. You go.
Yes. I got it with my new phone, actually.
Yeah. See? There are no dummies.
And you got Outlander, that juggernaut still.
Outlander's going well. They're almost getting ready to wrap production on their fifth season, which will be on the air in February of 2020. And that looks great and interesting. And then they're rolling right into season 6. And
wow.
Diana keeps writing these books. And we're not getting into the J.R.R. Martin problem. It's like we're never catching up and outrunning Diana.
She's still doing her job?
She just won't stop. So, hopefully that keeps us going too.
Well, fantastic. You going to come back next week? We'll just do this every week now.
Sure. It's my weekly podcast.
It's another Roncast. Co-starring Mark and Trish.
We got to get you for season 4. Right. You know.
We have to top ourselves from season 2. And how do we do that? We add one more body here. Well, thank you for sharing your morning with us.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. That was fun.
Thank you.
Yeah, we hope to see you again soon.
See you again.
Hey, so that was Ron. Ron had to go.
The lovely, lovely, lovely Ron, who graced us with his presence in his busy schedule.
Indeed. But we felt pretty lucky to have him here and could not hold him for that much longer. But we kind of talked about everything that was in the episode anyway.
We did. It's so amazing to just hear all the insight.
Yeah.
We went less scene by scene on this one, but just like everything that you, from the fat suit and how it started out as just to show time passing and then how they write it in.
Totally.
But we would be remiss if we didn't jump to the very end, which we're basically at anyway.
Right. There's a firing squad.
Holy. Under the guise, we've gone through, Baltar has been forced. We did touch on that. Baltar has been forced to sign the execution order.
Yeah. Mass execution.
Mass execution order. And having just come off seeing The Devil Next Door, if you've seen that documentary.
I have not, no. Ooh,
yeah. Just having finished watching that over the last kind of 2 weeks, seeing this was, jarring. And you've got these truckload of prisoners, Roslyn and Zarek among them, who we find out has been in captivity the entire 4 months.
Mm-hmm. And Callie.
And a bunch of others. Yeah, the faces we know. And they are being transported by Cavill and some others and some of the police force, Jammer being one of them. Mm-hmm. And they're let out for a stretch your legs 5-minute break.
Yeah.
And then we see Jammer pull Callie aside.
Jammer knows what's about to happen.
And says, he cuts her ties and says, run.
You should run. And then we see over the rise come a quintet
of centurions. And the police force books it out of Dodge.
Yeah, they all get out of the way, and Cavill slides around the truck, and
we cut to black and the sound of...
Well, Zarek, we see Zarek kind of pull Roslyn out of the front lines of the sort of civilians about to be shot towards the rear. And then as Callie runs through the woods, we hear gunshots and cut to black. And that's a pretty decent cliffhanger.
And there we will go into Exodus part 1.
Totally.
On our next podcast.
Yes. Do you have a frack down?
Oh God, I had so many of them. I keep starring in my little notes here. How many stars I have that we're frack down.
Wow.
Frack down. You're not seeing any stars. There's a few stars.
And all this, my God, it's full of stars.
I have one of the ones that I first mentioned was the one where you see the setup of the first suicide bombing, and you see the whole thing of, I've mentioned this earlier, it being played out and then finding out Baltar's not there and the whole rushing of time. Mm-hmm. I like that whole sequence. That might be my frack down.
Okay.
But something littler is a very snippet. Was when they first make the transmission they first make contact with Galactica.
Right. With the raptor that's in orbit.
Yeah. And Adama it's just a close up on his face and he says, it's going to be okay. It's all going to be okay.
Yeah.
And you're just like,
yeah. Like the message comes through. It's like, you know, yes. We will be here every 12 hours at the appointed time. Have faith. We're coming for you. And like the music swells and Adama's on the bridge and he's like, it's going to be okay. I have abandoned my guilt. It's a rescue operation. I'm back, baby.
Oh, yeah, I'm back. And yeah, I just thought, you know, you have that moment of like when Eddie says something like that, you know, like, okay.
Yeah.
He's back.
Yeah, I similarly was torn between two separate things. I was torn between the moment when Lee decides to implore his father to abandon his quest for revenge. Sorry, for rescue, not revenge. When he's like, you know, our charge is to protect humanity. And if you go guns blazing back to New Caprica, you're going to die. They're going to die. Everybody's going to die. That's not what we're here for.
And he calls back Rosalind's words.
Yeah.
After the first attack.
Yeah. Totally. And he says, I can't face it. I can't stomach it. I can't live with it. I have to go back. Your job is going to be to take Pegasus and go find Earth. I have to go do this.
Yeah, that's when they split, Pegasus and Galactica split.
And like he, you know, finally like kind of hugs his son and calls him son again and not a fat ass. Like that's a very sweet scene. But I think I kind of have to go with, you know, crusty old man Ty, you know, sitting there smoking his tiny European cigarette, saying that they're on the side of the demons, Chief. You know, the sort of heart of darkness of that character. And here's where he lives and here's what he's about. And there is no too far for this man at this point. It is such a perfect distillation of where his mind is. No, I love that. So that's that I think.
That was one of mine too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hogan is brilliant.
He's so good. I mean, the salt and pepper beard, the hat, the cigarette, the limp, the eye, all of it. Like here's a warrior, like on the end, at the edge of his hope, at the end of his days, like I have nothing left to give. So give it all.
Give it all. Exactly.
So yeah, those were our frack downs for the week. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
Let us know what yours were via the tweets.
The tweets and the interwebs, at which you can find both of us on readily. Nobody's hiding. We're out there in plain sight. And there's a lot in store for this season of the Battlestar Galactica. So we're going to get some more directors on with us this time around. We're going to get some more writers on, hopefully. I think we're going to have to find a way to pipe in Mr. Bamber from his French chateau.
I think we will. We may have to be up in the middle of the night for that.
We might have to, but if we're going to talk about unfinished business, it feels like, you know, we need either Jamie Bamber or Katie Sackhoff, potentially both. So yeah, that feels like a big one. And we're going to get Bear in here at some point. It's been too long since he gave us an awesome theme song. Thanks, Bear. So yeah, for this Battlestar Galactica cast, my name has been Mark Bernardin.
And I have been Trisha Helfer.
We would like to thank the good folks at Sci-Fi Wire for continuing to fund our crazy foray into the annals of history. We want to thank Brett, our new man on the ones and twos, for helping us sound all spiffy.
Woo-hoo!
Yay! And as always, thanks to Ron Moore for making the show that we're talking about and for coming here to talk about it.
And if you haven't tuned in before, that was Caesar at the beginning.
Yeah.
He got a little loud.
He was feeling it.
He was like, it's a third season premiere, yo. I can see Ron going, is that going to, yeah.
Do we need to cut that
stop?
Out? It's like, you have like a baby Chewbacca back there. So yes, we will see you next week for Exodus Part 1.
Yes.
Yes. All right. So say we all.